Welcome, everyone, to the January meeting of the Instructional Leadership Directors Roundtable. I'm your host, Justin Bader, and I'm honored to be joined today by Dr. Douglas Reeves, author of Achieving Equity and Excellence, which I have been poring over recently and pulling out some of those, as the subtitle says, immediate results from the lessons of high poverty, high success schools. So, Dr. Reeves, welcome to the roundtable.
Well, thanks very much. It's great to be back with you.
Why did you write this book? What did you see, as in terms of the reaction to your previous books, which are many, in reaction to the work and the articles that you've been writing for more than 25 years? What brought you to this particular book?
Well, there are two things, Justin. And first of all, thanks for hosting me, and thanks, Heather, for joining us, and to all your other listeners as well. I think, as you know, I started this work focusing on high poverty schools that were outside the mainstream. That is, high poverty, high members of ethnic minority groups, high members of linguistic minority groups, but that were also very successful. And, 25 years ago, we thought that they were kind of the outliers. And what I found is, in that original study, that it was not really what they bought. It wasn't their money. It wasn't anything else. It was a specific set of professional practices. And in the intervening time, to finally get back to your question about why I wrote this, is that I wanted to honor the scholarship of many other people who have done similar work. I felt, to some extent, a bit of a voice in the wilderness 25 years ago, but I specifically have acknowledged people like Karen Chenoweth, Heather Zadovsky, and many other scholars who have documented, even though we're all working independently, similar results. And so the reason that I wrote this is that I thought it was so important to say, this is no longer a voice in the wilderness. This is the preponderance of the evidence. This is where many different people coming together are finding very similar results.
Hmm. And that phrase, preponderance of the evidence, I recognize from one of the early chapters where you give us a framework for deciding what kinds of research or what kinds of knowledge to trust. And it's interesting to see actually two chapters devoted to that question of what is our source of knowledge, what is our source of expertise when it comes to whether this is possible, whether it is possible to get sustained high performance and results, even in a high poverty school that doesn't have all of the advantages of maybe a private school or a wealthier suburban district. And you say one of the kind of weakest forms of evidence, but probably the one that we rely on most, is simply our personal opinion, and then maybe one step up from that, our personal experience. Why does that become a trap? Why does personal experience and personal opinion become a trap, especially for people who have not really seen successful high poverty schools?
Well, it's part of what psychologists call the fundamental attribution error. We assume that what worked for us and our personal experiences can be attributable to everybody else in the whole wide world. Further, we assume that our motives are always sincere and noble. And when everybody else messes up, it's like the Puritans, that's God's punishment on them. But the truth is not quite that easy. I do respect people's individual beliefs and experiences, but in the research business, we call that a sample size of one. That is not the sort of thing that you can really generalize to the population. And so I mean no disrespect to people's beliefs, but what I'm requesting is that we also consider, what does the evidence broadly say? Different researchers, different locations, different scenarios. And I think the evidence in this book is pretty strong, that a lot of the things that people traditionally say, well, gee, if they're poor, if their parents are not well-educated, then they're just stuck. I recognize that is true for some students, but it's simply not true for all, because there's too many cases of high poverty schools doing well as a result of great teaching and great leadership that I think we need to recognize.
Absolutely. And, that kind of brings us to level three in your levels of educational research, and that is collective experience. And, the evidence is there, as you mentioned, from your own work and from Karen Chenoweth's work, and of course, organizations like Uncommon Schools. There are many examples of excellence in high poverty schools. But when we think about our collective experience, often if we're working, and I started my career in a high poverty middle school, and probably the lowest performing high high poverty middle school, not the only high poverty middle school, but certainly, you know, there was variation within a demographic band. There was variation in school performance within, you know, the same demographics. So that's definitely something to keep in mind. But, you know, if I looked at our collective experience as a faculty, if I looked at my colleague next door, if I looked at my colleagues down the hall, the collective experience that we had, and I think the collective experience that probably the majority of people who work in high poverty schools or who have worked with high poverty schools, is that as much as we would like it not to be the case, demography seems to be destiny. You know, that if you come from a poorer zip code, if you don't have the family advantages of wealth and real estate and opportunity, that there's this direct relationship between, you know, parental wealth, parental education, parental assets, and student achievement. And if I understand what you're saying correctly, like that's an illusion or a thinking error to say that just because I personally and the people immediately around me have experienced that direct and kind of causal relationship between poverty and low achievement, that we generalize that. We say that it has to be that way.
I think that's a really thoughtful insight, Justin. It is, and it is confusing cause and effect. For example, if I'm used to, for the last 20 years, being in a school where home environment, poverty, and that sort of thing is associated with low achievement, I assume that the former caused the latter. Whereas what I found in the schools that I studied is actually the causality is the other direction. If I start with low expectations because the kids are poor, because they can't do it, a wonderful new study from the New Teachers Project you probably read showed that kids that are getting A's and B's in secondary school, only 17% were even asked to do grade level work. So the variable wasn't poverty. The variable was the expectations that the schools and the teachers had. And they're rewarding with honor roll grades, terrible work that is not on grade level, because we think, well, gee, that's just the best they can do. Bless their heart anyway. So my respectful suggestion is let's rethink causality. It's not from poverty to low achievement, but it is rather from low expectations to low achievement. That's the causal direction.
It's very interesting you say that. I was interviewing Dr. Tracy Benson yesterday, a professor at the University of North Carolina who did his dissertation work at Harvard Graduate School with Sarah Fireman. And they were talking about implicit bias. The book is about implicit racial bias. And obviously we think about discipline as a source of, you know, as a nexus of racial bias and disproportionality. But one of the first examples that he pointed to in our interview was low expectations, and not by giving lower grades, but by giving higher grades for non-grade level work. And that took me aback for a second, because, you know, I realized that like that focus on standards and that focus on doing grade level work is absolutely critical to the achievement that we're trying to get. Like, we don't do students any favors by somewhat grading on a curve for poverty.
So it's not as bad as all that. It's actually worse. And here's the evidence. In a study that I did, it isn't just that poor kids wind up getting high grades from low work, but I analyzed in specific, 9th and 10th grade students who had failed literacy and math exams and yet were on the honor roll. They were disproportionately members of ethnic minorities, and they were disproportionately girls. And I say this with deep respect. Maybe some of you have read my article called Cheating Our Daughters, but our daughters get rewarded for being quiet, for being compliant, for getting along, not for doing grade level work. And it particularly affects our daughters who are members of ethnic and linguistic minorities. And we do them no favors. In Florida, for example, there was just a study published this week, in Florida, 70% of incoming college students need remedial classes. And when they have to take those remedial classes, it doesn't count toward graduation. They don't get financial aid for it. So we are killing these secondary school students with high grades for low-level work.
So I wonder if we could talk about the gap between the confidence that you express in this book that we can succeed and help students achieve high levels of academic success according to rigorous standards, regardless of their level of poverty. How do we square that with the commonplace observation that the more resources, the more advantages, the more assets students start with, you know, the larger the vocabulary, the more they've read and been read to prior to school. How do we square that with just the gap in advantage that students start with?
So that is a very fair question. And I take a very different point of view than some of my friends who also advocate for high poverty students. I have no resentment toward rich kids. What I want to do is learn from them. So what does a rich kid get? A rich kid probably was read to in the womb. A rich kid, by the time they came to kindergarten, had 5 years of literacy instruction. A rich kid may still struggle reading, but if they go to a $50,000 a year private school, nobody says, sink or swim, kid, you should have had that earlier. They say, oh my God, what are we going to do? This kid's rich. We'll give them intervention. We'll give them support. We'll do whatever they need. So seriously, what I mean is, if we taught poor kids the same way that we teach rich kids, which is the assumption that they will always succeed, they'll always be okay, and that they deserve it because they're rich, that's what we must do for poor kids as well. Moreover, when it comes to rich kids, with all the extra years, as you suggest, in early childhood, in infancy that they had, why in the world wouldn't we give them the extra support that they need later on? So to be really precise about this, if a rich kid is getting all this stimulus in terms of reading and literacy and all these other opportunities outside of school, why would we think that a 60-minute or a 90-minute literacy block in school is enough? Rich kids get more than that. Why wouldn't we give that to all of our kids? So I harbor no resentment toward those kids. I just want to learn from them and then replicate what our wealthy, advantaged kids get in every other school that I see.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a very different philosophy. And I'm sure people, you get very shocked reactions from people when you talk about that $50,000 a year school and the advantages that brings. But you know, if we look at what specifically is being done to make a difference for kids, I think often about my own kids who are in elementary school now. And I will say, despite my background as an educator, I'm not a literacy expert. I definitely did not, use any esoteric literacy knowledge to help my kids learn to read. And certainly their kindergarten and first grade teachers deserve all the credit for that. But seeing what has actually allowed them to start reading far above grade level, it was fairly simple. And a lot of it comes down to time. You know, they read for several hours a day. I'll brag a little bit. We're a small group here, so I'll brag a little bit. My daughter won the county spelling bee, and I overheard one of her friend's moms telling her, you studied the words, yes, but Vivian is reading novels every week. Like that is what it adds up to. And it's like, that was not expensive, right? That was not something that is only available to people who go to private school. You know, our kids go to public school, they check books out of the library and read them. And I think one of the messages that we take away from your research is that these are accessible strategies. We don't have to go and spend a fortune on some program that was specifically designed for high poverty schools to do some sort of magic with high poverty schools.
Well, and Justin, I really appreciate you mentioning that, because sometimes my research has been misinterpreted to have people say, well, gee, Doug is thinking that poverty doesn't matter. Of course, poverty matters. Food insecurity matters. Sleep deprivation matters. All these things really matter. All I'm trying to say is that it's not determinative. And with respect to the money issue, look, I will always argue for more money for schools to pay teachers to have safe and secure facilities and so on. The problem is, there are really dysfunctional, unhealthy schools that have a lot of money, that have $25,000, $30,000 per pupil allocations, and they're still failing. So money is part of the equation, but it's not sufficient. And that's all I'm trying to say. And in fact, sometimes, again, bearing in mind, I will always argue for resources for you. Money can be a curse. What I've seen in my other research that I talked about briefly in this book is the lack of focus. Every time a new grant comes in, every time more funding, Title I, state funding, and so on come in, people buy another program. And so I see, and I'm not exaggerating here, not just 20 or 30, 60 or 70 programs in a single school, and the teachers are just buried in initiatives. So yes, I'll advocate for resources, but we got to spend those resources in a focused way that allow teachers to really give our students what they need. The last thing I'll say is that money is one resource, time is the other one. And so it's interesting to me how rich kid schools, to come back to our conversation, spend more time than poor kid schools do. I'm astounded that in some of these poor schools, a kid might have a 9-period day, and in the same number of hours, a rich kid will have 5 periods. That is, they're getting almost twice as much time per period in a rich school than as a poor school. And I want to make sure that our students are getting both the money and the time that they need.
Well, and I think that time issue shows up in a couple of places. One, of course, is instructional time and the time for deep work. But I also see that in that difference in the time for adults to succeed with any change initiatives. And we work with one private school in the Toronto area that's been highly successful for generations, very, very expensive school. And I'll periodically check in with my contact there. Hey, what are you guys up to? What are you working on that's new? And usually the answer is, we're not working on anything that's new. You know? And it's interesting, you know, and we think, well, that's because they don't have urgency. And I think, well, no, it's not because they don't have urgency. It's because they have focus. Like, those are two ways of looking at that that lead to very different conclusions. And I think certainly remembering my time working as a teacher in a high poverty school, but, you know, the lack of focus definitely was part of what ran people ragged and led to, you know, fairly high turnover. And just the lack of, you know, are we going to be doing the same thing tomorrow, much less next semester or next year?
Well, so Justin, you just mentioned something that also, particularly since we're going to have a lot of leaders watching this, that's part of the issue of cause and effect. Rather than assuming that the cause for low student achievement in high poverty schools is the student characteristics or their family characteristics, what you just said about turnover, that's the cause. Turnover of administrators, for example, in high poverty schools is almost 5 times greater than leadership turnover in low poverty schools. The same is true of teachers. Oftentimes, and I say this with affection and respect to my union colleagues, but if you've got a union bargaining agreement that says with more seniority, you can move farther and farther away from a high poverty school, what does that mean for your system? That the highest poverty school always has the newest, least experienced teachers. And that's not fair. Where I hope I can find common ground with my union friends is, let's provide financial incentives. Let's provide extra time. Let's provide extra support, so that our very best and most experienced people are willing to and incentivized to remain in a high poverty school.
Yeah, I think if we could cut turnover to the level that turnover is in a, you know, in a wealthier school or in a, you know, a more middle class school, I think that alone would do so much. And there's a particular quote that you had. You know, we can get grants for lots of new programs. You know, we can always get a grant to start an initiative, but Amy and I were both reading last night. She was reading a novel, and I interrupted her to share this quote from your book, where you said something along the lines of, "Nobody will give you a grant to stop doing something." Is that the? Do I have that right?
That's great. I don't know if I said it, but somebody certainly should have.
Yeah, I think that was the quote. I don't have it in front of me, but you know, basically this idea that the urgency is always around doing something new, doing more, and never around doing less with more focus. I think our colleague Mike Schmoker deserves some credit for his book Results Now and his book Focus, and into really calling a you know, calling attention to that the power of focus. But you know, in your paradigm of kind of looking at what you know, what wealthy schools do and what the most successful schools that work with high poverty students do, that, you know, that is definitely there, that focus and that sustained attention on a small number of priorities, which we should get into the priorities that you talk about in the book.
I just want to appreciate the fact that you mentioned Mike Schmoker. Interestingly, yeah, Mike and I have been friends for many, many years, and we were actually neighbors in Colorado. And we both published a book on focus. Mike's book, Focus, with ASCD, and my focus at Columbia University Teachers College, Finding Your Leadership Focus, were published within days of each other. And we were both came to astonishingly similar conclusions that focus, in my book, Michael Fullan wrote the introduction, six or fewer priorities is really the hallmark of successful schools. So thanks for mentioning, Mike. You also mentioned uncommon schools, and I didn't want to let the opportunity go by to fail to recognize Paul Bembrick Santoyo, who has written splendid new books on that as well. So I really am trying my best to recognize other scholars and not make this the Doug Reeves show, but recognize people like Mike and Paul, Heather and Kristen, Karen as well.
Yeah, well, it reminds me of the invention or the discovery, however you want to put it, of calculus, right? There was a parallel discovery around the same time. Was it Newton and Leibniz?
Stood on the shoulders of giants.
But, you know, like working separately came to the same conclusions and came to the same discovery of the tools that were necessary for solving particular problems that were widespread, but that, you know, the solutions did not exist. You know, when you see that the same discovery has been made independently in multiple places, such as this discovery around focus, I think that tells us something powerful, and that it's not just, I think we always have a tendency to do something and then feel proud of it and then try to generalize it and say, well, we've discovered the secret that everybody should use everywhere. But when you see it actually popping up independently in different places, it's a strong form of evidence. Yeah. So in the book, you describe a three-column approach to looking at factors that we cannot control or influence, factors that we maybe can influence but not directly control, and factors that we can control, things that are under our control as educators. What do you think is happening, what do you think we lose when we fail to distinguish between those three categories of factors?
Well, I think just at the heart of your question is a really thoughtful analysis of what efficacy means. Unfortunately, a lot of people are talking about efficacy these days. You know, certainly John Hattie has found efficacy to be very powerful. Robert Marzano's latest meta-analysis finds efficacy powerful. The problem is we don't operationalize what does efficacy mean. And efficacy is this bone-deep belief that what we do influences student achievement. But the problem is you don't achieve efficacy with this kind of inspirational song and dance. You achieve efficacy rather with, as you suggested, this three-column approach. Hey, there's stuff I can't control. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. Kids are awake on the internet, checking their likes and dislikes. I can't control that. They have access to alcohol, tobacco, guns, drugs. I can't control that. So that's this pile over here of stuff I can't control. But there's also this middle pile, things like attendance, things like tardiness, which I think people used to think we can't control. And maybe we can't control it, but we can influence it. Because I've seen too much evidence that things like attendance, parental engagement, tardiness can be influenced by what we do. And then over here in this column is stuff we absolutely control. And that is stuff like relationships with students, like effective instruction, like checks for understanding, like good assessment, like fair and accurate feedback. That's stuff we absolutely control. So we got these three piles. I can't control, I can influence, and I do control. Efficacy is all about the right-hand column. Is there more stuff that I influence and control than what I can't control or influence? That's all it is. And so I sorry for the little mini lecture here, but all I'm trying to say is don't give your teachers a lecture about efficacy. Ask them instead, what causes student achievement? And then put those causes in three piles. I can't control it or influence it. I can influence, can't control it, and I can absolutely control it. And then look at how much paper is in those three piles. An efficacious school has all the paper, you know, 80, 90% of it in the I can control it or I can influence it.
I was thinking about a book that I read last year that made quite a splash called The Knowledge Gap. I don't know if you saw that by Natalie Wexler. It appeared in The Atlantic and there are pieces published all over. And knowledge, Natalie Wexler argues, really is the thing that other knowledge sticks to, right? The knowledge is cumulative, and I think that's represented in Bloom's taxonomy. And you know, we've kind of known that in the technical literature for a long time, that knowledge sticks to other knowledge, that accessing students' prior knowledge is a big deal. And it seems to me that one of the it's one of the factors that makes closing the gap harder. You know, when you have students who start on third base, so to speak, they've been read to, they've been exposed to National Geographic, they have all this content knowledge, they have all this understanding of the world and vocabulary. And that to me seems to be one of the harder gaps to close, you know, when some students are reading a couple million words a year, other students are reading very minimally. What do you see as our opportunity? You know, what's in our, either we can control or we can influence, knowing that what students have read prior to kindergarten or what students are reading outside of school may be less under our control. What do you see on the knowledge front there?
Okay, so that's a big question that I want to unpack on several different levels. First of all, yes, I respect Natalie Wexler's work, and I want to kind of amplify on that before I get to the big heart of your question. I think she's got it half right, which is the background knowledge contributes absolutely to reading comprehension and to student success. The scholar to read, in my judgment on this, is Daniel Willingham, who's got a wonderful blog, and I really recommend Professor Willingham, University of Virginia's work on this. Where I think Ms. Wexler is maybe wrong is attributing all this to charter schools. That's a piece of the action. It's not all of the action. The label, if we've learned anything, of a school doesn't matter. It's the practices that really matter. So put that aside. I just don't want your listeners who have one strong opinion or the other on this to be put off. Let's instead of accepting or rejecting a scholar, say here's where they're right, and I hope they'll probably say the same thing about me. Here's where Doug's right, here's where Doug's wrong. I really respect the fact that she acknowledges background knowledge is important. I would disagree with her on some other things. Similarly, another scholar that she cites, Robert Pondiscio, is fabulous in this great book, How the Other Half Learns, and I think he's so honest and so forthright. Witness the fact that he's been criticized by every side of the educational debate. That tells me that you're doing something right. So shout out to Robert. Now, back to the issue of all the prior knowledge. You're right. I can't control what happened in the previous 5 years. But what I can do is to say, what do I do to level the playing field? So one of the things you mentioned, you know, your children, as mine did, literally, we can't have a breakfast table conversation because they can barely get a spoon in their mouth because there's a book like this. I love that. You know, I'm never upset about that. They're reading all the time, as I'm sure your kids do as well. But a lot of kids who come from a home that doesn't have any books in it don't get that. So instead of complaining about it, that to me suggests what do we do during the school day to get them more opportunities for literacy? And I want to be really specific about this. If you're only having kids read 60 or 90 minutes a day, and you know that they've got a literacy deficit that is in the hundreds of hours, maybe thousands of hours before they came to you, why would you settle for 30, 90, 60 minutes a day? Moreover, it's not just about reading. It's about writing as well, writing in response to text. And finally, here's the thing that I just saw this week, Justin, that really bugs me. The kids have got the headphones on, and they're being read to like they were 3 years old instead of learning to read. And so technology is not always your friend here. We got to make sure that our students really are reading and not just zoning out in silent reading time. I have an article that I wrote that some of your listeners may be interested in called Rethinking Sustained Silent Reading, that frankly is, in my judgment, oftentimes sustained silent sitting, that they're not really reading. And so if we want to close that literacy gap, you need more time and you need more focus.
Time and focus again. Yeah. So I was thinking about that. I was pondering that issue a little bit, and I drew myself a little, you know, factors I can control, factors I can influence, and factors I can't control chart for this particular issue as you recommended. And obviously students' prior background knowledge, prior experience reading, their vocabulary, when they start with us is something that we can't control. But, you know, it's always interesting to me to hear people say, well, our kids just don't have the background knowledge. They just don't have the vocabulary. And I think, well, wait a minute, which column does that go in? If we're teaching a unit, we're introducing a concept, we have some big ideas for a unit. I mean, obviously, what is the first thing that we've always known we need to do? And that is explicitly teach the vocabulary and help students, master that vocabulary and not just act as, you know, as you indicated earlier, and I think you say in the book, you know, like, well, you should have learned that before you got here. You know, like what sense does that make to say, well, they don't have the vocabulary, they don't have the background knowledge. Like that is our job. And we know it's something that we can do. We know for a fact that we can teach vocabulary. We can teach background knowledge.
Well, and Justin, I just want to make sure that we add a morale issue here that is affecting a lot of your listeners. This is not, when we talk about vocabulary, for example, that's not just an ELA issue. I watched a masterful science teacher in a 100% poverty school this week explicitly link vocabulary from one lesson to the next, from one subject to the next. You probably heard about this in social studies. You probably heard about this in English. And weave really complex vocabulary into a science lesson. And I've seen art teachers with high ESL schools link vocabulary to vivid visual imagery. And so my request for our listeners is, please, for goodness sake, don't put this in the back of the teacher's contested grades, contested subjects. All of us own this, art and music and science and social studies. And yes, ELA and math, I know those are the people who feel under the microscope, but all of us own this. The other thing, just as a footnote on vocabulary development, is we got to start early. I mean, the great schools that I was studying in this book are all about what do we do in kindergarten and pre-K. Shout out, by the way, to the University of Washington and the University of Pennsylvania for an amazing study of the lifelong impact of early childhood development. When we do early childhood, pre-K and K well, it not only, these scholars said, influenced how those kids did in fourth grade and eighth grade, it influenced how their own children did 30 years later. And so we got to make sure that even though, as leaders, I'm talking to you, board members, superintendents who are watching this broadcast, if you leave out kindergarten and pre-K from your accountability report, you're leaving out some of the most important things that we do, because that'll have literally a multi-decade influence.
Absolutely. And I think about the importance of universal pre-K and how Oklahoma, of all states, which has some of the most dismal funding at the moment for education. You know, we have huge problems with teacher recruitment and retention in Oklahoma because the salaries are so low. And a lot of these stories about teachers taking weekend jobs at Home Depot are coming out of Oklahoma because the salaries are like, they just do not have the money in public education. But one thing that, I don't want to say it's an accident of history, but because it was very intentional, but one thing Oklahoma has been very strong in is universal pre-K. And that's one of those things that maybe as individuals, we might not be able to pull off, but it's an example of how when we take responsibility for what we can influence, what we can control. You know, I might not be able to control how much parents read to their kids from birth to age five, but we can do pre-K. At least with the sufficient level of political will, we can.
And just one footnote on these scholars, and I am terribly embarrassed. I can't remember the names of the authors, University of Washington in Penn. But nevertheless, please give them credit for this, not me. It's not just daycare. This is really right. Educational pre-K and kindergarten. And what I do want to acknowledge that I can name the scholars on is Glenn Malenko and Jill Chokol in Dearborn, Michigan, where in the same school, you can see kindergartners writing sentences. And there's other places that I go where they'll say, oh, gee, that's not developmentally appropriate. Not in Dearborn, where it's high poverty, high second language, kindergartners writing sentences. So it really is all about our expectations, things that we can do.
Yeah, well, that you mentioned writing, I think, is a great excuse to get into some of the specific strategies and you know, which make up kind of the center of the book here. So you talk about a number of specific instructional strategies. So you talk about collaborative scoring, nonfiction writing, and data analysis and formative assessment, which I want to make sure we talk about each of those three in particular. But again, back to refer to our colleague Mike Schmoker, who talks about the importance of this. Why is nonfiction writing so critical?
So this is interesting, and thanks for letting me again acknowledge not just my work, but somebody else's work on this. Stephen Graham, and now at Arizona State, formerly at Vanderbilt, has written masterfully about this. What I originally documented was the relationship between nonfiction writing and increased scores in math, science, social studies. And in my original work said that the hypothesis is, gosh, if you spend time in writing in, during math, science, and social studies, I don't have time to cover the curriculum, so my scores are going to go down. And the truth is that when I looked at the actual data, the teachers in math, science, social studies who spent more time in writing had scores go up. It was exactly the opposite of what their hypothesis was. So writing, King says, is thinking through the end of a pen. Now, why nonfiction versus fiction? What I specifically compared in this research were schools that had identical demographic characteristics, high poverty, high minority, high ESL populations. And what kind of writing were they doing? The low performers were doing fantasy, fiction, haikus, you know, poetry. Hey, I'm all for haikus. Hey, poetry people, please don't send me angry emails. You can have all the haikus you want, but writing to describe, writing to compare, writing to evaluate. One of the things you see in a lot of state tests, claim, evidence, reasoning. This is not just, by the way, K-12. I'm helping universities these days redo their stat classes to say, how can I look at an advertisement in Education Week, in Ed Leadership, in the Wall Street Journal, you know, wherever it happens to be, how can I look at an ad and say, is the claim supported by the evidence? That's the kind of critical reasoning I want all of our students and frankly, all of our graduate students to have as well. So that's, Justin, why I think nonfiction writing is particularly important. And that does not in any way diminish my appreciation for fiction and for literature, but I want students to write to show their thinking.
Yeah, well, it really seems like a direct window into student thinking, student reasoning, and then thinking about my background as a science teacher, a window into misconceptions. You know, misconceptions are a huge part of rigorous science instruction, because if you're just talking generally about a topic and you're not getting into what students' misconceptions are, you know, some of the details of how a system works in the human body, or how a system works in the cell, or how plate tectonics work in earth science. Like, if we're not accessing students' prior knowledge and understanding their misconceptions, we're going to waste a lot of time teaching. And I think you talk about this a little bit in the section on PLCs, which are the first strategy you talk about, where we don't really spend very much time figuring out what students already know and what we're going to do with that, right?
So I don't want to lose the opportunity as a science teacher for you and a math teacher for me, you know, to not acknowledge our listeners who are thinking, wait a minute, how does a science teacher, how does a math teacher do writing? And I don't, you know, shoot, I've written 39 books, but there's a lot about writing that I don't understand that my English language arts colleagues do. So the best thing that I've seen in the last couple of weeks, and I'll see if I can get this on the screen here. Okay, it's this big. I saw a science writing rubric that was literally 2 inches tall, like that. So they weren't asking the science guys to do voice. What they were asking for is, don't just settle for filling in the blank. Don't settle for a worksheet. Write the lab report. Explain your conclusions. Tell me how the conclusion stems from the evidence. That's the sort of thing that in my geometric proofs and in Justin's science classes that they need to be able to do. So let's make clear that we get writing established, whatever the subject is, not in this big elaborate 5-paragraph essay, but in something that is better than a worksheet. And too many people are defaulting to worksheets. So sorry for that little diversion, but I thought it was really important for our science and math teachers who are watching.
Well, I think it's a perfect parallel to our work as instructional leaders, because honestly, you know, I primarily spend my time thinking about instructional leadership, teacher evaluation, teacher observations, feedback conversations, and we kind of do the worksheet thing with teachers as well, or for ourselves, we, you know, as instructional leaders, often the task we give ourselves is to go into a classroom with a worksheet and fill it out about the teacher. And my analysis of what that gives us is that it gives us something that is fairly high inference and fairly low evidence. And I always am, you know, admonishing people to think, you know, if you want to change teacher practice, right? If as an instructional leader, you want to get into classrooms and change teacher practice, you have to understand, you have to know and access the teacher's thinking, right? Like, practice does not change without thinking changing. And if I'm just going in and filling out a worksheet or a walkthrough form or whatever about the teacher, I'm not really getting evidence of the teacher's thinking. So I don't really know what my job is in helping change that teacher's practice, because I'm not even sure what thinking is behind that practice. And that to me is really where practice lives, is in thinking. And to hear that we do the same thing with students and fail to access their thinking in the form of writing, and we instead give them worksheets where they fill in the blanks, like, that to me is a clarion call to align both what we do as instructional leaders and what we ask teachers to do with students around that firsthand evidence that comes through, it can certainly come through conversation, you know, and I absolutely recommend that administrators have conversations with teachers, ask questions, you know, get their insights and explanations of their thinking. And then certainly in writing as well, we see that with student learning and misconceptions and their current understanding.
Yeah, so I just want to highlight what you said a minute ago about asking students. I want to encourage so we have a lot of assistant principals and principals watching here. Be careful about the way that you do observations. Too often, the model that maybe we had as teachers is the administrator, all dressed Natalie, sits in the back of the classroom like this, and we're watching. Don't do that. What Dick Elmore at Harvard says is look down. Don't watch the performance by the teacher. They're all ready for you. Every preacher's got a great sermon, right? They're all ready for you there. Look down. What I always do is I sit with the kids and I ask two very non-sophisticated questions. Question number one, what are we doing? Question number two, what comes next? This is not a big worksheet to fill out, right? It's not this giant 30-page, evaluation form. Just what are we doing? What comes next? And if a student could tell you that, then you know that they're on task and they know that there's not a minute of downtime. And if they can't, I don't care how great the lesson plan looks. I don't care how great the performance by the teacher is. If they can't tell you what are we doing and what comes next, you got a problem. So seriously, let's make sure that we have our observations down to those essential questions.
Absolutely. And then I love the opportunity that nonfiction writing gives us to look at that evidence after the fact, and not just collect it anecdotally as we're in the classroom, which certainly is valuable in its own way, but to actually take that student writing and use it to plan instruction, to identify gaps that we need to close with our teaching. And one of the practices that that you identify in chapter 5 of the book is collaborative scoring. And I would love to have you take us into that, but I just have to share a personal recollection from being a principal. I remember sitting in second grade team meetings. When I was a principal, we had an extremely strong second grade team that would give periodic writing prompts, and they had a particular prompt that they would give at different times of year, and they would flip the cover page or put a post-it note over the name, and they'd shuffle it, they'd mix them all up, they would score each other's, they would cover the score, pass it to the left, and then someone else would score that same paper, and then like basically their entire PLC was talking about those scores. What did you see in this paper? I gave it a different score than you did. And by the way, we don't even know which student we're talking about yet. So there's we're looking for a very specific set of things. We have a rubric, and then we're constantly calibrating our assessment of that work, and then ultimately figuring out what to do about what we're seeing. So I just have to say, I can't take credit for what that team was doing, but I witnessed it. And there was a magic and a power to it. So take us into that a little bit. What is collaborative scoring? Why does it work so well?
Well, I'm smiling so broadly because there are several things that you said that just resonated with me so much. Number one, the fact that we disagree, and we always will, we're professionals, we disagree about things. But the hallmark phrase that I use in these scoring sessions, as you described, is the enemy is not each other. The enemy is ambiguity. If you think it's a 4 and I think it's a 2, that's not because you went to a better college than I did, although you probably did. It's rather that the scoring guide, the rubric, is ambiguous. And what we have to do is to make sure that we resolve the ambiguity. And the ambiguity is not you against me. The ambiguity is this inanimate object over here, the scoring guide or the rubric. So that's number one. Number two, I really appreciated what you said about teachers kind of gaining momentum. One of the things I've done, so to the leaders watching this broadcast, consider doing this. I surreptitiously timed how fast people got. And it was great. So I have two graphs. One is, what's the level of agreement? And it goes from like 20%, 30%, 90%, 95%, never 100, but it's pretty darn good. So the agreement gets higher. But the other thing that I graphed that I concealed was speed. And the time it took to reach consensus got shorter and shorter and shorter. Man, when was the last time you had a staff development meeting where you could say, I'm going to improve quality, but I will save you time? Teachers resent the fact that they don't have enough time, they got too much time, too much to do and not enough time. If we can approach them and saying, this process of collaborative scoring is, as you just said, Justin, will save you time, and that is the hook that I think teachers really respect and appreciate.
Yeah, the recapturing of time that you know, that's being spent anyway. I think, yeah, absolutely. So in that scoring, you know, and when we have you know, we have standards that we're working toward, we have you know, shared criteria. Help us think about the formative assessment system that this is part of, because you talk about in chapter 7 using frequent formative assessment with multiple opportunities for success. So how does the collaborative scoring relate to that frequent formative assessment practice?
So I want to offer your listeners a consumer warning here. There's a lot of stuff being called formative assessment that is what I have described in another book that I wrote called uninformative assessment, right? It's teachers say, oh, thank goodness that's over. Now we can go back to what we were doing before. That's not formative. It's only formative if it informs teaching and learning. So be really clear about this. A lot of things called formative assessment. Publishers are trying to sell you stuff. And I hope everybody knows I'm not aligned with any publisher. I'm completely independent. People are trying to sell you stuff that is called formative that is not formative. So it's only formative if it informs teaching and learning. So that's kind of big idea number one. Big idea number two is, you don't have to sample every content domain. What you want to be able to do is to say, how are things that I can learn about what will help me next week? So some formative assessments are literally 40 and 50 items. Friends, you don't need that. 4 or 5 items, a few things on what's most important that you can grade the same day. You can give students feedback immediately. That's what effective formative assessment is. So I didn't mean to go into a big diatribe here, but I worry about the term formative assessment being misused. It's short, it's immediate, and most importantly, it informs me as a teacher. What helps me inform teaching and learning?
Yeah, and I think there are some critical distinctions there that we often do lose because the you know, the pressure, I don't want to say pressure, but, you know, the amount that we get from our test vendors often causes us to pay attention to what the test vendors are giving us and not what we might need to make ourselves. You know, nobody is coming into our school with money that we've spent on them to make us, you know, give these kind of curriculum-based assessments. The pattern that I've seen with some of the more commercial assessments is, you know, stepping away from those curriculum-based and standards-based and, you know, kind of mastery-based formative assessments and toward things that are useful, but in a different way. And I want to give a particular example that I hear a lot about, that I experienced a great deal of as a principal, but I think we do have some misconceptions around, and that is the MAP assessment from NWEA, which is a norm referenced assessment. It's often given 3 times a year in elementary and even middle schools. And it's one of the few things that both I experienced as a principal and my own kids experience as students years and years later. And I think it's a very high quality assessment for what it does. It is a norm reference test, and you get a RIT score that tells you where your kid is relative, you know, where each student is relative to the norm for their grade level. But of course, and this is a common complaint of teachers, you don't get to see the items. As an educator, as a teacher, you don't see the items, and it's not aligned to, you know, the unit that you're teaching right now. It's aligned to important content. I don't think anybody argues that, but it's not aligned to what you're teaching. So what's your thought on that, and what gaps does that leave that we need to fill in terms of formative assessment that is linked to our curriculum and our standards?
So Justin, you've nailed the essence of the issue, and that is there's always a trade-off. I understand and respect the fact that test vendors, whether they're NWEA or for that matter the ACT and the SAT, they want to have security over their items. So that's why they don't disclose them. The problem is, if you don't have that kind of disclosure, you lose the link between the test item and the curriculum. Did the student miss it because I was a bad teacher, because the directions were ambiguous, because maybe the item wasn't related to the curriculum that I taught? So there's all these things that remain. So all I see is math low, reading high. That doesn't tell me anything about how to improve as a teacher. So back to what I said earlier about formative assessment. It's only formative if it informs teaching and learning. Let's me be a better teacher. Let's my students be better learners. And so here's my consumer advice to our leaders and policymakers who are watching this. Don't buy stuff that is not transparent. If teachers can't say, and if that means, excuse me, if that means that we create them ourselves so that the assessment items are open and transparent, great. So what's the trade-off? You lose some item security. I think that's a potential loss, but honestly not that big a one. The gain in terms of how does it help me inform teaching and learning is much greater. So I'm not trying to take pot shots at SAT, ACT, NWA, or anybody else. I'm just saying that their concerns about test security, I think, are overwhelmed by my concern about teaching and learning. How do I, as a leader, as a teacher, use these data to better inform my practice?
Yeah, and you know, it strikes me as a teacher, you know, I think there's been a good effort among educators to recognize and respond to the fact that, like, if a question can be memorized or Googled, you know, there was a lot of concern maybe 5 years ago about students Googling the answers to their homework, when that became kind of broadly feasible, when students universally started to have smartphones at the secondary level, you know, and some leading educators started to say, well, wait a minute, maybe if you can Google the answers to your homework, maybe it's not very good homework. You know, maybe we need to, you know, if we have to keep it secret for it to be useful, maybe we need to look at, you know, the kinds of tasks we're giving students, so that it's not homework that you can cheat on. It's, you know, it's an assignment that I want you to know what you will be asked to do on the test. You know, the test is not locked in a vault. I will tell you what's going to be on the test. You're going to have to write an essay, or, you know, there's some opportunities there.
So Justin, you are inspiring me to brag on two great teachers that I so admire. I'm just in their fan club. One in San Bernardino, California, Michael Dahl. Another one happens to be in Lima, Ohio. These are both very high poverty systems. And in contrast to our stereotype of students sullenly sitting in their places, either going through homework or listening to a boring lecture on why the quadratic equation will make them healthy and successful in life, what they're doing instead is they were all 100% out of their chairs, doing the work on the board, correcting each other's work, getting real-time support. That's what great homework is. My principal, Mr. Robinson, used to tell me that homework has nothing to do with the word home. And I love these two teachers in different parts of the country, in very high poverty systems, but they had the homework done where it really mattered, on the wall, right in front of the teachers, right in front of their peers. And I just don't want to miss the opportunity to tell these teachers in both Lima and San Bernardino how much I respect and appreciate their work.
And it's funny you mentioned that, because I referenced the elite private school in Toronto that had that sustained focus for years and years. And that was one of their sustained focuses, the board writing, especially in math, to solve those problems publicly and to get feedback and to, you know, prompt discussion. So again, it's interesting to see the same things popping up independently in different places. So as we start to run out of time here, I wanted to make sure I ask about an accountability system, which you have the fourth section of the book is on accountability as a learning system, system level accountability. Give us some kind of key thinking points for that topic.
So I want to acknowledge for our United States listeners, we're governed by ESSA, the Every Student Succeeds Act. For our Canadian and other listeners, I realize that every province has got its own own jurisdiction with respect to accountability. But nevertheless, if I've learned anything from the North American continent and abroad, it is that nobody, no country in the world does a satisfactory job of saying, what is the world, what does the word accountability really mean? And so I'm asking you as leaders to say, let us redefine that. And what I tried to say in this book is most systems around the world focus on effects, test scores, attendance, discipline. What I'm asking you to consider is a focus on causes, teaching, leadership, parental engagement. In other words, what do? That we own, that we take responsibility for. So maybe the best illustration I can offer for your consideration is what I've called the science fair. We all know what a science fair looks like. You probably had them in third and fourth grade. But in this science fair, there's no red and purple ribbons, okay? Just plain a display. What were my challenges? What were my interventions? What were my effects? That is my results. So challenge, intervention, results. That kind of science fair display is what really good accountability looks like. In other words, it's the difference between accountability as a gotcha system. So here's going to be your rating and your rank and your brand that will stay on you to humiliate people, or accountability as a learning system. Here's what we learned about the relationship between a challenge, an intervention, and a result. I'm an advocate for accountability to be learning. And that's, I say with deep respect to all of our ministers of education and policymakers who are watching here, I want to respectfully request you rethink this. It's not about labeling. It's all about learning.
Well, and I love the role that you're essentially casting system level leaders in there as kind of organizational scientists, right? As chief scientists of practice, you know, and looking at the evidence, looking at the practice that is being employed, and looking at the results that that's getting, and leading continual cycles of inquiry. I think we're so quick to look at data, we're so quick to look at our numbers, but it takes courage to look at practice and to look at firsthand evidence and look at student work and talk with students about what they're learning and to talk with teachers about what they're doing. But I think we get the most out of that, and I have to do a little internal commercial here. So for our members of the Instructional Leadership Directors Roundtable, one program, if you're a member, that you have access to is the Organizational Learning Intensive. So you will find that in your member dashboard. And I strongly encourage you to go through that whenever you're about to plan a new initiative, whenever you onboard a new cabinet member, maybe you're hiring an assistant superintendent, have them go through that and get that that vocabulary and that scientific way of thinking about change, because, you know, obviously we want data, we want to use our data in smart ways, but we also want to make sure that we are using the other evidence that's available to us, especially the qualitative evidence about what people are actually doing, what people are thinking about their work, and how that's impacting students. I think that firsthand qualitative evidence really got short shrift in a lot of our fervor over quantitative data, which has its place, but it doesn't give us the whole story. So just wanted to make an internal kind of cross promotion there for something you already have if you're a member, because what Dr. Reeves is saying here is, you know, it's essentially that we do need to be that chief scientist for the organization if the organization itself is going to continue to learn and get smarter and get better at what it is that we're here to do. So I think we are out of time today. And Dr. Reeves, I just want to thank you again for spending this time, for being here to talk about your work. And I certainly want to encourage people to check out the book, Achieving Equity and Excellence. And I have to say, one of the things I love about this book is that, you know, as it says in Ecclesiastes, there is nothing new under the sun. You know, there is nothing in this book that you invented 2 months ago, I don't think, but it just the clarity and the you know, the, as you said, the preponderance of the evidence and the you know, increasingly sharp focus on what we need to do, I think, is much needed. So, you know, I think it would be a mistake for someone to say, well, nonfiction writing, I've already heard about that. I read about that 10 years ago. You know, in some ways, that's kind of the point, isn't it? I don't know. What's your thought on that kind of nothing new under the sun aspect?
So just two quick things. Number one, you're right. We are famous in education for always going after the shiny new object. What's the new thing? When in fact, what you want to say is, what are the things that have endured over the course of time? And I think that endurance is one of the things that is really important for our listeners to consider. I've attempted, the second thing is my favorite graduate school professor always said that she would read students' work backwards. That is, start with the reference list. So this is absolutely not about me. This is about the preponderance of the evidence, about other researchers that I've tried to acknowledge. So yeah, you know, I've tried to be a pebble on the mountain of research here, but look at the mountain. Don't look at my pebble. Look at the mountain of all the research that's there that says we can succeed in high poverty schools, that nonfiction writing is effective. You know, the last book that Rick and Becky DeFore wrote before they passed away, they co-wrote with me, called Responding to the ESSA with Professional Learning Communities. You know, these are things that are not new, that are the preponderance of the evidence over time. And it's not just me, it's multiple scholars. So I'm not asking anybody to read this book because I wrote it. I'm asking you to look at the reference list and see what everybody else has done.
Very well said. Well, Dr. Reeves, once again, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your time today. If people want to get in touch with you and see what you're up to and maybe reach out about doing some work together, where's the best place for them to find you online?
So to be clear, lots of free stuff. It's all at creativeleadership.net. So creativeleadership.net, you'll find free videos, articles. And Justin, if you don't mind, there's a couple of new volunteer projects that I've got that I'd like to highlight as well. Also free and non-commercial. Many of your listeners may be working on a dissertation. So I have a group that I started in a church basement in Boston called finishthedissertation.org. Finishthedissertation.org. I started it because 69% of graduate students never finish their dissertation. We have helped them for the last 6 years cross the finish line. You don't have to be there in Boston. We have students on six continents all over the world. Finishthedissertation.org. And then the newest one is called the Marsh Writers Collaborative. You can go to Marsh Writers, M-A-R-S-H, marshwriters.org. And it's about helping people who are writing their first book, their first article. And it's just writers encouraging articles, writers encouraging writers. So if you're a writer or you aspire to be a writer, please consider going to marshwriters.org and we'll help you also get your first book or your first article published. That's our mission.
Love it. And I have to say for many of our listeners who are superintendents, assistant superintendents, or maybe on that track, those are two projects that often are running on a parallel track, maybe on the back burner, depending on what else is going on. But thank you for sharing those. So marshwriters.org and finishthedissertation.org. You know, I think one of the nice things about both of those types of projects is that, you know, if you have been away from them for a while, you can always come back to it. You know, you can say, okay, maybe there was a season where health or family or, you know, organizational factors interfered with that happening. But I just want to encourage anyone who is, who maybe has an unfinished manuscript or has half an outline or has an unfinished dissertation to pick that up again, because, you know, the world needs your work to, you know, to reach the light of day. So thank you, Dr. Reeves, for your commitment to helping people with that.
Well, thanks. It's my pleasure. And I want to be clear, you don't have to live in Boston, either one of these. We have people joining us on the internet from all over the world. So wherever you happen to be joining us from, these offers are free and available to you.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for your time today. And we will be in touch soon. Thank you so much to everybody for tuning in. And we'll see you next time.
Take care.